Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday, July 8th, 53 degrees in Old Town. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. We do have a great day in the forecast, Leslie, so it's pretty exciting. Now, the normal high temperature for today is 82. We're going to keep it just a little bit cooler for today in the low 80s at 80. That's still a pretty decent day in the forecast. Lots of sunshine. The good news is we're not going to see strong winds like we've been seeing the past couple of days, simply because we have a stalled frontal boundary. But what we will see would be a light northerly wind for today. Now, the story is going to be much different for tomorrow. Temperatures are going to climb quickly. We're going to see 85 as the expected high for tomorrow, and it's going to be very sunny. Now, on Friday, a few extra clouds enter our forecast. There's just a little bit of a piece of energy, a short wave that enters and brings us just a few clouds. Otherwise, temperature 87 degrees. So we're already hovering right around that 90 degree mark. Saturday, we have 89 as our expected high temperature and 88 on Sunday. The trend is going to be sunny from there on out. But also, I want to mention, it is going to get breezy starting Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So, of course, we'll have to be mindful of any fire weather concerns. Also, be mindful of your outdoor activities, simply because it's going to be a lot warmer out there. And just make sure you stay hydrated and apply sunscreen often throughout the day, simply because UV indices are going to be so high. The warm trend continues through Monday. 84 is the high. And then we hit 80 on Tuesday, so a little bit cooler. But this is going to be an amazing stretch. Today is the coolest day for the foreseeable future, and I'd say enjoy it. We have a nice weekend ahead and lots of sunshine, so I think this is a perfect forecast.
Okay, thanks. KPCW News Time now, 8:07. It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Park City Summit County Arts Council Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder, along with Mayor Andy Bierman. They'll be talking about the art mural project on Main Street. Park City Manager Matt Dias and Deputy City Manager David Everett with a preview of the agenda for Thursday's City Council meeting, which includes an update on the Arts and Culture District, and Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bulla with an update on the COVID-19 situation in Summit County. Also, a reminder that we've got walking tours of the Park City Mountain Base Resort. That's happening through PEG development companies at 1 and 2 o'clock. Park City Planning Commission will be meeting there at 3 o'clock. We also have at 1 o'clock a Summit County Council meeting. They're touring the Silver Creek Village area, meeting there at 1 o'clock, and then an electronic Zoom meeting starting at 4:15. Wasatch County Council meeting starts at 3 o'clock, and the Park City Planning Commission Zoom meeting starting at 5:30 tonight. Also, stay tuned for the Mountain Life coming up this morning right after the local news hour. Today's guests include psychologist Carol Hughes and family therapist Bruce Fredenberg, who discuss their book, Home Will Never Be the Same, then local Park City resident and adventurer Dinanette Wells, who has climbed the 7 summits and is a longtime adventure racer. She is appearing in the Amazon Prime video show Eco Challenge, which actually debuts next month. Stay tuned. Well, taking a look at local news now, the coronavirus was a major topic for a special meeting of the Councils of Government held yesterday. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that the attendees traded concerns about how they will enforce the county's mandatory mask order. On the positive side, they heard that the Oakley Rodeo went well, though it was scaled down and COVID conscious.
Among the comments during the COG meeting, Camas Mayor Matt McCormick said he supports the mask order, given the number of people who come through Camas, but he said it's also frustrating for him and the town's police force.
I feel like it's easier for a business owner to ask someone to put a mask on or leave their business than it is for us as a government and as a police department to enforce it based on the nature of the environment in today's world. It's just difficult for me in Camas with a police department trying to figure out or justify putting my police officers in jeopardy of an unmasked person or an irate person for a mask infraction. Now, if it turns into disturbing the peace or public disturbance or something like that, now in my mind, it's a different conversation and I feel like it's much easier.
He wondered how they should react if the mask issue sparks a confrontation.
Let's say someone walks in a business wearing a mask, following the rules, and gets completely out of control because someone else isn't, and the cops get called. It's likely that both could be cited for disturbing the peace or public disturbance, and that's not the intent, but that's the situation that's being created in this environment.
County Sheriff Justin Martinez agreed it's a difficult situation. With the lack of personnel in his department, he said he's relying on education, and his deputies are equipped with extra face masks.
And what we're really doing is if somebody is an actually complete violation, we may issue a citation, but we had a gentleman come into the Justice Center without a mask on, recording his actions and trying to invoke a confrontation with some of my deputies, and basically said, I'm in the Justice Center. You guys require a mask. Are you going to arrest me? And we just had a conversation with him, said, no, we're not going to arrest you. It's not an arrestable offense, and we're not going to issue a citation. And it deflated the whole situation.
Among other comments, Park City Mayor Andy Bierman said they appreciated the county's order, and city businesses liked that they don't have to take the heat over any mask requirement. Meanwhile, Oakley Mayor Wade Wolstenhume echoed some other concerns from the east side, saying he felt that the county's COVID precautions had been focused on Park City operations, worried about the upcoming winter, and not the east side, which is in its busy season. On a related topic, though, Wolstenhume said that Oakley's rodeo was a success.
We had around 600 contestants come into town and leave town. We had 1,500 people attend the rodeo each night. We actually took the temperature of every contestant and every person that entered the facility, and I'm not aware of any fever or symptomatic person that came in.
He said they had some good fireworks displays. Their patriotic program drew just 150 people, but worked well outdoors. And instead of a 4th of July parade, they had a parade of homes with cars driving past decorated residences. He said the event didn't see the same profit as in past years, but they didn't lose money.
It just goes to show that you can still live. There are scary things that happen to us all the time, and there's fear of something all the time. And we just got to be aware and take all the precautions we can, but we got to keep living. And I think as far as, you know, implementing the mask and things like that, I think it's more or less how you do it.
Oakley Mayor Wade Wolstenhume. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
KPCW News Time now, 8:15. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, four murals were painted the length of Park City's Main Street, including the words Black Lives Matter, as well as other messages of solidarity and justice for all. The project was coordinated by the Park City Summit County Arts Council. It was supported by Park City Municipal. Some love it, some aren't too happy about it. And this, on the phone, I should say, to tell us more, I have Park City Mayor Andy Bierman and the Executive Director of the Arts Council, Jocelyn Scudder. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Andy, let's start with you. Can you talk to us a little about the impetus for this? I really never heard about it. It wasn't on a council agenda. Did it need to get run through the council?
Yeah, it did actually come up, I think, two council meetings ago when we were talking about our 4th of July activities, that we would be painting equity-based murals on Main Street. But because we really did not want to over-promote any events or activities, and certainly not draw crowds or protests from Salt Lake, we didn't overly promote this. We wanted to do something special this year for July 4th because we canceled the parade and the fireworks. So we closed down Main Street. We activated it lightly in a way that would attract up locals, and we picked activities that we felt like would allow people to distance and spread out on the street and be engaged. And we thought this was the perfect time to highlight our art on the street. And because this community has been in the midst of an equity discussion, we thought it would be very timely to have that art themed on racial equity.
Yeah. What was the budget for it?
I believe we spent in all about $15,000 that went as a grant to the Summit Arts Council for them to pay the artists, I believe, for their costs and supplies. And that's, I've had a few reactions to that, but I want to point out that every weekend that we close the street, the city's been paying for various activities on the street and the cost of blocking it off and having a police and event staff out there.
Yeah. And what was it that the city asked the Arts Council to do?
I'll let Jocelyn answer that one.
Okay.
Sure. The Park City Municipal approached the Arts Council to create some temporary art murals on Main Street. And so we talked about what we really wanted the subject matter to be. And we figured it was a great time to kind of capture this national and international moment while people are talking about race. And also, as Park City has a critical priority of social equity, to really invite some Black, Indigenous, people of color artists to come up and respond with their artistic interpretation to produce a series of these murals that address issues surrounding racial equity and social equity in light of the Black Lives Matter movement and the recent nationwide protests. And so this project is one of several initiatives to support the dialogue and the conversation around the community's social equity priority, which strives for equitable public administration of services, justice, social well-being for all. And, you know, from an Arts Council perspective, we know that, you know, art connects us, art inspires us. It serves as a platform to communicate. It's a mode for self-expression. Art can help us gain new perspectives. It illustrates the human experience, which allows us really to understand each other better. And so these murals aim to do exactly that.
Yeah, you mentioned that they are temporary. I rode up Main Street this morning to look, and it looks like they have faded pretty well already. So were they designed to last a week? Or
they were designed as temporary. This is this community's first time doing street murals on the asphalt. But, you know, doing the research, we know that these there's a lot of wear and tear, more than most murals that we create, because we have cars running over them all the time. They get a lot of sun exposure, especially if they last through the winter. You know, we have plows coming through. So the city will basically monitor them from here on out and decide, you know, as they continue to deteriorate, when the best time to remove them. But for now, they're going to be, I think our goal is as long as they're holding up through the summer.
Oh, okay. So, Andy, I mean, is that the idea, is it to remove them, or you just let them wear off as they do?
I don't think we've made a final decision on that. I think we're going to see how they age, and if they, you know, I think we'll likely let them fade as opposed to formally remove them. But if they become an eyesore, I think we can remove them.
Sure. And certainly, as you know, some people are concerned that that they don't think the city should be endorsing or promoting ideologies. And they think that you've done that here, especially with the Black Lives Matter logo of the raised black fist. So did the city go too far here?
I don't believe so. I mean, this was art intended to make us think. And I think the critics we've heard from, many of them haven't even been up to Main Street. So I really encourage them to come up there and see the beautiful art. And I struggle to understand how they would be offended by messages of peace and unity and solidarity, love, justice, and even the Black Lives Matter message. This is not that's an artistic rendition. And I think it's a concept. The city, you know, the city's already come out and made statements against police brutality and in support of solidarity with communities of color. But we're not necessarily endorsing a particular organization. These are all concepts that we're discussing in our equity discussions. And I've had people go so far as to accuse us as dividing the community, and that was by no means our intention. And if I think anything, this has maybe uncovered some divides we have and pointed out why we really need to have these equity conversations now. And it makes me all the more grateful that we started 3 years ago building the capacity for these discussions. And I view this as a great launching point.
Yeah. Where are these discussions happening, though, other than social media?
Well, that's the challenge in COVID. We haven't been able to have all the do the community work we'd like to. Right now, we're working on organizing a forum, which will probably happen in the next couple of weeks. And that will likely involve the Christian Center, the city, the Community Foundation, and the Summit Arts Council, where we'll talk about these murals and other equity issues that are going on right now. And we're going to have to figure out how to have these really difficult discussions through new mediums, just because of this virus right now doesn't allow us to come together to have these discussions.
So this would be like one of the Friday platforms that you do, the Friday morning?
Yeah, that was the initial discussion, is we would do it as a roundtable, but I think we want to make sure that as many members of our community can participate as possible. So we may do it in the evening or pick an alternative time. We haven't finalized it yet, but we think there needs to be at least one, I'm guessing multiple conversations revolving around race and equity and the current social unrest in the country and maybe how that plays into the hard work we're trying to do here locally. And certainly the new voices we're hearing that are upset about these murals, I really hope that they will come out and express their point of view on this, because when we had the recent community visioning, people overwhelmingly came out saying that we need to focus on equity. I think it was about 80% of our community wanted that to be a priority, and they went so far as to say it's the area that most needs worked on and is the most urgent.
Yeah,
Josh, I'd love to add to that, Andy. You know, I know we've discussed about having these community forums. You know, obviously these murals have sparked a really important community dialogue. And it's the artwork, you know, it's the artists. They are their own spokespeople. And so, and it's really about their messages. We're, you know, the art is sharing their experiences. And we are providing a platform. The Arts Council was a coordinator and facilitator in this. We're so grateful for the city's support. But it's about these Utah-based artists looking inward at our own communities in Utah and how they may feel racial equity, you know, how they interpret it, and how this is their message. And so we really want to invite the artists to come back and talk about those messages, open up that really difficult dialogue. You know, I think the work that needs to be done is approaching this with a lot of empathy and a lot of compassion. And these conversations are uncomfortable. I know there were a ton of conversations that happened this weekend. And so while there is dialogue happening now, we want to make sure we maintain that momentum and talk to community members who are in support of this and who are concerned about it, because that's the tough work, in my opinion. And I think in the end, there's going to be a kind of a positive healing outcome as we talk to these artists and look inward at our community, at the racial inequities that exist in Utah and maybe even here in our mountain town.
Yeah, Justin, just talk a little bit more about who you got to paint this, because, of course, there's the criticism, again, on social media saying that you know, it's just another display that Park City is somehow progressive and got a bunch of white folks to paint this. But looking at the photos that you've posted, it looks like that's not the case.
It's not the case at all. When we approached this, obviously, addressing racial equity is a charged conversation right now. It's difficult. We acknowledge that we are a dominantly white arts council, but we also are about to launch a new strategic plan where we are going to prioritize and continue to prioritize diversity, equity, inclusion, and access in all of our programming. And so when we were approached with this really meaningful project, we felt it was absolutely important that we hire artists of color to tell their story. We didn't want to hire white artists to talk about race. Obviously, that would be a miss. And so we did a lot of outreach to different state and local community organizations. I talked to some people who ran Mural Fest, some of the public art boards. We even reached out to some social media groups. One, Brown Empowerment, sent out a call for their artists. And we ended up, we didn't have a ton of time to produce this. When we found out the streets were going to be closed for both the 4th and the 5th of July, we launched this project quickly. And we ended up cultivating Bill Lewis, who is an artist who's actually been in our community before. And he was born on the island of Fiji, and also he has some Samoan background. We also hired Aljay Fuimano, and Aljay is the artist who created the Black Lives Matter mural, and he is Polynesian. And we also hired Mariela Mendoza. Mariela is from Peru, and the Roots Art Collective, which is a group of three Latinx artists from Salt Lake. And so all of them, you know, producing murals also is a very specific art form. There's a lot of skill planning, you know, executing a piece of artwork this size is a feat, to say the least. And so it's a very, you know, a specific art form, and we had to do a lot of research to find artists that were interested in doing a crazy, you know, large scale
street mural project had the time, could come up on a holiday weekend, and had a message that they wanted to share with our community. But we have artists of color who we invited into our community to share their stories, and there were a lot of meaningful conversations that came out of that throughout the weekend.
All right, and they're all facing the east. Was that planned to be that way, or instead of kind of staggering them?
It was planned that way. We knew that we were going to be taking some aerial shots, and so when we cultivated these artists, we ended up coming together as, and they, again, they are their own spokespeople. They had a message. We didn't censor them, right? They wanted to talk about causes that were meaningful to them. And so we kind of formed a little committee, artists and the Arts Council and the city, to talk about these murals, the execution, the size, the scale, how do we measure this? And they all decided to include type, to include work. That wasn't originally part of the designs, but they all came together and decided that they each had a message to share. So, you know, I loved that collaboration process, that thought process. And I think it really unifies the murals together. As you look at the street from an aerial view, and as you're walking down the street, you're getting these messages, you know, that the artists are sharing. And I think it makes it all that more impactful.
Okay. Well, I'd like to bring you back in and talk a little bit more about your strategic plan, about how you're going to change some of the programming up. But Andy, I have just a minute left. Can you talk a little bit about how the car-free Sundays are going?
There's something else I'd rather talk about, if you don't mind, Leslie, and I'll try to touch on it. But I just did want to make a comment. There's been some folks looking at this in absolutes, and some criticism that this is a statement to against our police. And I just want to say that we very much value our police in Park City, and we think that the unit of community policing we built here is the step that the rest of the country should be headed in, and that our officers are as offended as anybody by the acts of brutality they've seen. And the chief signed on to our statement last month opposing police brutality. And I was there kneeling at the protest with Sheriff Martinez and Chief Carpenter. And so our police do have our full support. And we think, like the rest of the company, we need to reexamine and make some refinements. But I was really grateful for the citizens that came out and thanked all the police that were on the street this weekend, and told them how much we understood how difficult their jobs were, and even more difficult in these particular times.
Okay.
So with that said, the closure of the main street, I've heard mostly positive things. The residents have really enjoyed it. It's allowed us to activate it in some ways that that bring new activities to the street, that space people out, and that's been appreciated. And what I've heard loosely from the businesses, that all things considered, business has been pretty good. So I would be curious to hear from Allison Butts and some real numbers at this point. But I think so far it's mostly been a success.
All right. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman and Park City Summit County Executive Director of the Arts Council, Jocelyn Scudder, thanks so much for your time this morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time 830. It's 8:31. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Council will meet in an electronic work session starting at 4:30 tomorrow to get updates on the Arts and Culture District, the car-free Main Street, and sales tax numbers. On the phone with a preview, I have Deputy City Manager David Everett. We're hoping that City Manager Matt Dias calls in shortly. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Leslie. We got Matt on as well. I merged him in.
Okay.
Good morning. Matt's here too.
All right. I prefer, just so you know, it's easier for me, but that's okay to do the board here. But anyway, David, you're of course overseeing the Arts and Culture District, and you're looking for council feedback on the uses of the district, the proposed funding sources, the construction timeline. We know it's the location for the new Kimball Arts Center and Sundance Institute offices. But what's the Park City part? I mean, it sounds like we're trying to be a lot of things. We only have 5 acres of property. How much of that does Kimball and Sundance get?
I appreciate that question. We're really focused on the city's portion of the development tomorrow during the council meeting. And the majority of the site is going to be city-owned and managed property, which includes, as you know, significant affordable housing component and two levels of parking underground and a major transit transfer point for the region. So that also includes a really really, I think, expansive and an inclusive plaza area on the surface that really goes the length of the property there from Munchkin all the way down to almost to the point there at Kearns and Bonanza.
Okay, so in terms of the affordable housing, how many units are we talking about?
We're talking probably right around 40. We're still in the process of adjusting it, and my guess is that as we go through the master plan development process with the planning commission and planning staff, that'll adjust based on their feedback as well. Even in the last week, we've been tweaking the numbers because we've been working with a design committee, a group of folks locally who have expertise in all things arts and culture, as it were, and food and beverage. And based on some of the input we've gotten from them, we've really added space at the plaza level for more activity and move some of the housing units that were planned for the plaza level, hopefully off of the plaza level, and so that creates even more activity and a sense of activation on the plaza, which is really, you know, one of the main goals of this project.
Two levels of underground parking. How many spaces and who are they for?
I think it's going to be between 250 and 300 spaces. Also, something that adjusts based on the sort of what you want to call the commercial requirements of the housing requirements for the site. So it's all this. It's this interesting hydraulic relationship between housing, parking, transit, and the activities that, you know, the commercial, to use that term, activities that are happening on site as well. So it's all going to move around, but we're looking at probably 250 to 300 spaces. And those are for the housing units. Those are for, in anticipation of the retail and the commercial and, you know, all of the class activities and the art studios that are happening on site.
Right. So are these paid spots?
You know, my guess is, we don't know for sure yet, but my guess, if I had to at this point, would be that it'd be a similar model to China Bridge, where, you know, during less busy times, it's not going to be, there won't be a charge, but then during peak times, there probably will. I mean, this is not a park and ride by any stretch. The goal is to really encourage and incentivize people to use transit or active mobility methods to get to and from the site. And so it's we'll really be focused on that from a policy perspective. And, you know, how you manage parking is a huge piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, and since it's a major transit stop, how much bike parking will there be? And will it be underground and lockers and things like that?
It'll be premium, primo bike parking for sure. Probably underground, certainly covered, certainly protected, certainly would be, it's a priority to make sure that it's safe and inviting, and it's that bike parking is the least of anybody's issues getting to and from this site.
All right. And then what about the commercial aspects of it? Again, I mean, that's what you're going to need, is to kind of help pay the bills here. Many of us already lamenting the closure of Anaya's.
Sure. And I'm sure the Maverick as well. I know that was a major community touch point. But the way that we're thinking of this district and the way it's been planned thus far, and commercial is probably a strong word. I mean, it's a lot of activity that revolves around classes, a media arts center, a food hall that's a significant portion of this. And so there is going to be opportunity for some retail, but it really is focused on what can creatives do on site to produce their work. And in some cases, that will involve being able to sell that work on site, but that's not the end-all, be-all of the project necessarily. But renting space and being able to use space for events, for rehearsals, for productions, that's going to be part of the business model to help offset the cost of managing the facility.
So Anaya's is not coming back? I thought we had already heard that it was.
So the plan has always been, in that I'm aware of, that Anaya's will definitely be back in the area, but likely to be part of the Homestake development. That's that triangular piece, just about a half a block away from the Arts and Culture District itself.
So there have been discussions that the city suspend the project, but we're going to go forge ahead, huh?
Well, that's a council decision, and they'll be discussing that tomorrow night. I certainly wouldn't speak for them, but I do think there's a really strong case for moving ahead. You know, it's times like these where we really think we can capitalize on some really beneficial financing costs, potentially opportunities there to benefit in terms of construction costs and bids coming in. And, you know, I've been in this business quite a while, and I've seen this, you know, for lack of a better term, the stimulative effect of doing these kinds of projects when the economy's in a really dark place. And I think that, you know, for it's sort of ironically fortuitous timing in a way that we have an opportunity to really create jobs and bring people in to do the kind of construction work that this project would require at this time.
And are Sundance and Kimball ready to push forward as well? I mean, I haven't seen any purchase agreements. And again, just given the fact that they've both laying off people, do they have the funds to pay for the parcels?
You know, I don't want to speak for them necessarily, but I do know that they're timing-wise, they're probably looking at a different time frame. You know, the city's still very enthusiastic about being partners with them moving forward, but we totally understand that they face different realities as nonprofit organizations, and it's really going to be their schedule. They need to go with whatever schedule works for them in terms of thinking about their organizations and how buildings relate to that. So, you know, we have a plan where timing is flexible in terms of the other organizations that would come on, and we're moving ahead with the city's portion of the project with that flexibility really baked into our plan, because a lot of the construction work, honestly, that needs to be done to get the district going, no matter when the partners came on, has to happen ahead of their construction regardless. So we do have some really baked in flexibility in terms of timing with the project.
All right. The payment for the $19.5 million purchase price was coming from the new 1% municipal transient room tax. With the big hit to the lodging industry, what kind of impact is that going to have on the city repaying this?
No question that it's an impact. That way the transient room tax got hit with the COVID-19 and the pandemic, it was significant and is significant, remains significant. We did get a little bit lucky in that the vast majority of the fiscal year revenues associated with the transient room tax for the fiscal year that just ended at the end of June, you know, timing-wise, we've gotten the majority of that revenue in already. However, looking forward, you know, we're trying to budget really conservatively. The impact of COVID definitely takes a lot of sort of cushion out of our projections moving forward, no doubt about it. But even with a conservative approach, the way I've really budgeted for cash flow for this thing moving forward, I don't anticipate, you know, the conservative approach has been to not expect PRT revenues to return to pre-COVID levels until approximately fiscal year 25. So that would be like July of 2024, so about 4 years out. You know, hopefully it'll come back sooner, but if not, you know, we're projecting that, and that with the way that budget works, with the way those cash flow works, we still are able to make the project pencil.
Yeah, so maybe this is a Matt question, but does this tax, this 1% municipal transit room tax, eventually go away once the land is paid for, or do you continue to collect that tax and infuse it into the district?
Matt, you want that one?
Sure. No, I don't think there's any intention, at least initially, that it would go away, but obviously that would be a policy decision for city council and the mayor. I know that some of those resources will be required for ongoing maintenance and operations of the district, but that would be a decision for a future council, that they could either take away the tax, or they could repurpose that tax, or continue to plow it into reinvestment in the district.
Okay. And then I think I read that we're talking about a $70 million project, $18 million for affordable housing, $8 million for the transit infrastructure. And that $70 million does not include moving the substation or power lines. Do those have to be moved?
The power lines definitely have to be moved, at least in part. But as and there's budget separate budget for that the council set aside already as part of their capital budget. However, as I dug into this project and had looked at some of the history around it, I know there had been discussions previously about relocating the substation in the area further or over, I guess, across the street on Bonanza. But I don't think that's on the table, just to be clear. I think what we're doing right now is some analysis to figure out if realigning that substation or moving it even not very far, but in a way that really opens up the potential for that area to work well in terms of future development. I think, you know, if you're ever going to do it, now's the time to do it. And it's complicated by the fact that a lot of it's a transmission line issue that for lines coming in and out of there, and the way that they are aligned right now, it's really constraining for the both the arts and culture site itself, but also for the neighboring properties, including the one that the city owns on that triangle piece. So we're really just doing some analysis right now to figure out if it makes sense financially and if there's a different funding source to possibly look at realigning that substation and maybe even burying power lines in the area. So that's a future discussion that's related but separate.
Okay, I have just a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to talk about a few other things. Matt, the sales tax update. Looks like we saw a slight drop in February, a decent increase in March over the monthly projection, and even April looking a lot better. So while it's certainly off, it looks like maybe the city's projections were too conservative.
So this is Matt, and Leslie, that's the hope, actually. We've obviously had to amend our projections from where we started at the beginning of our fiscal year, but things are trending slightly above what we had amended in April. So for the benefit of the public, we have a fairly cogent update about our sales tax revenue over the course of the year. And the last slide is really, really interesting that we included. And it includes information from the Google mobility data set. And the poignant thing here is the number of people coming in and out of town that we're able to track through different devices. And it's trending, you know, getting close back to normal over time. And so, you know, the trends look good. We are obviously trying to be very conservative in our projections. But things are going, you know, well so far, and we do believe there is a road to recovery here. That's the silver lining.
Yeah, well, it looked like we're more than $500,000 more than what was projected through April. Again, I know it's still off of where we should be, but so that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, I think for all intents and purposes, you know, we tried to be very conservative out of the gate. No one really understood the nature, the depth, and the extent, and the length of the COVID impact. So intentionally, we were very conservative in our projections, and you know, so far so good. We haven't had any problems with that. But you know, as most folks know, we have relatively a $4 million shortfall this existing fiscal year that we had to close, and we have a $9 million reduction in next year's budget that we had to close. So we intend to continue projecting conservatively, but the mobility data that we're tracking for the number of visitors to town, individuals moving in and out of grocery stores and retail establishments, bars and restaurants, is positive.
All right. We don't have time for it, but I'd like people to know that you've got lots of Old Town pilot projects in progress. We're also talking about some technology upgrades for China Bridge and talking about a rebrand of China Bridge. We're not going to call it China Bridge anymore.
Well, we don't know. We've had some complaints from visitors, maybe from businesses, that when individuals are visiting town and they're, you know, trying to be directed to our Old Town parking garage, commonly known as China Bridge. The first question is, what's that and where is that and what's China Bridge? And so when people are looking at online applications now using different types of mobility apps, we would like to have a future discussion about a potential rebrand of that facility in order to drive more vehicles to that facility as their first destination. What we're finding now and some of the feedback that we're getting through our parking attendants and some businesses is that cars will typically loop around Main Street looking for parking, be told about China Bridge, not really understand what it is, and then eventually find it. The extent that we could reduce some circling and have that be a primary destination, that would be preferable. So that'll be a future conversation that we'd have with council. To back up, though, we are interested in piloting some additional mobility improvements in our residential neighborhoods and commercial district. I think that council's saying this might be a good time to try some things, use different types of paint, put planters in the right of way, you know, elevate the level of service for pedestrians and bicycles, and if there was ever a time to try it, it's now when town's not as busy as it once was.
Finally, the cannabis reportedly pharmacy isn't going out into the county after all. It looks like it's going into the basement of the Emporium space there on Kearns Boulevard. Any comment from the city about having that in town?
No, not really. I don't think it was unexpected. You know, we were working on this piece of legislation, Gus, I think almost 2 years ago and following it closely. I think, you know, a lot of leaders in the town and business leaders and city council and the mayor, you know, figured that this might be one of the first sort of destinations of this type of an outlet. And in Utah and in particular in Summit County, we bring in millions of visitors from all over the world. And as this is kind of a groundbreaking enterprise in Utah, we're not surprised at all that we would be an early destination for this type of an outlet.
Okay. Hey, Matt, David, appreciate your time this morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, the Summit County Board of Health met on Monday discussing the after effects of the mandatory mask order, as well as the number of cases of COVID-19 we're seeing in the county. On the phone with an update, I have the director of the Summit County Health Department, Rich Bola. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you holding up? It's summertime. Have you even had a day off since this all started in March?
Not many, but I'm doing fine. We've got a good team, and while I'm sometimes the face of this, we've got a whole bunch of people working on it, and we're all supporting each other.
Yeah, and surprisingly, you need thick skin for this job. I think your critics, you know, saying that you're on some kind of power trip here. Do you care to address them?
No, I actually don't. I don't think there's anybody involved in trying to manage this pandemic. And that I use the word pandemic intentionally. It isn't Summit County that's going through this. It's the planet that is going through this. And in fact, in Summit County, we're not doing very many things differently than many other communities across the globe. And so, there's none of us that want to be in the middle of this. And we're all trying our best to make sure that we can balance public safety, public health, and the economy. And, you know, hearing Matt talk about the data, mobility data, that's a perfect example of trying to balance things. It's good that the travel is up. It's good that the business and the economy sector is beginning to show signs of life. But on the flip side of that, you know, we see a surge in cases. And so it's just a matter of balancing. And that, I guess, is the take-home message for the public. We're not trying to completely squelch this stuff, because we understand that to do that, it has significant impacts to business and economy. So we're trying to find that balancing point where we can live our lives, people can be employed, business owners can own their businesses and pay their bills, and we can still keep the cases reasonable so that we have capacity in our hospitals and we're protecting vulnerable populations. And so it's all about balance.
Yeah. You have heard some upset people at Monday's meeting about the mandatory mask order. We've seen lots of social media comments about how people come to Park City to shop because masks are required. Others saying they're taking the business to Wasatch County because they don't have to. And it sounds like you may be reconsidering this decision about where people have to wear masks.
Actually, not at all. We're firm on this was the right decision to have a mask order in place. And the intent, I want to communicate with the public that the primary focus of requiring masks is to keep businesses open. It's really our best tool at this point in time. If we are going to encourage the movement that Matt was just referring to, encourage the travel, encourage people coming here, drive people to businesses, get our revenues up, do all of that, and protect the employees and protect the communities who actually live here, the individuals, the residents, the workers, our best tool is masks. So what we are working on, and the Board of Health will be hearing some appeals coming up, is refining the order. And we've already gone through one amendment, and that amendment clarified some language that allows some more judgment with respect to mitigating risk. And then we're also, as I mentioned, the board is going to hear some appeals from specific industries. The primary appeal, the biggest appeal that they're going to hear, has to do with wearing masks during exercise, indoor exercise. And so we're gathering data, compiling the best evidence that we can get on both sides. And I want to make that clear. The health department is providing information to the board that they will review that is both pro-mask within indoor environments with respect to controlling COVID and managing COVID, but also what are the risks? And so I think it's important that we have a public hearing to have that discussion and the board make a judgment on that with all of the information in front of them. And obviously it's a public hearing, so there'll be an opportunity for individuals to speak and present their own cases as well.
Yeah, lots of talk in the news about how leaky masks are and a lot of contamination even when wearing one. Is there any way to kind of track infections in a way that would tell us if people wearing masks are still getting sick?
Well, the data are really clear. this is it's interesting. Nothing is completely black and white, but there's been multiple studies done on epidemiological studies, first of all, so population-based studies that have compared mortality, spread of COVID, all kinds of different factors in communities and cultures that encourage and wear masks and those that don't. And it's very clear that mortality is decreased with masks. Spread of COVID is decreased with masks. And so those are those population-based studies are the ones that I believe we need to look at, because we're dealing with populations. And every time that you focus on a specific individual, an inconvenience, or, you know, somebody getting a sore throat by wearing a mask, that's not the take-home message. We're trying to manage this condition across a population of people. And absolutely, you know, masks can be inconvenient. I've been wearing one now for several weeks. I've gotten used to it. It's become a reflex to put it on when I'm around anybody. And certainly in indoor settings when you're in close proximity, et cetera. So that, you know, the evidence is clear. And I know there's always going to be people saying it isn't. But I'm very comfortable in where the data fall and what the conclusions are related to masks stopping or at least controlling the spread of COVID by about 80%, 70 to 80% decrease in spread.
Is the county putting any pressure on the governor to issue a statewide mandatory mask order this week? I mean, we've been hearing that may in fact happen.
You know, I'll just be really forthright. We have not. In my view, if we had a state order, it would make things a whole lot easier for everybody. We'd have, you know, consistent standards across jurisdictions, across county lines. Your comment earlier about people going to Wasatch or people coming here, et cetera, that issue's taken care of if we have consistency across county lines. And part of the problem in communicating all of this from the very get-go with the public was variability across county lines. It makes it hard on businesses, hard on the public. So I'd like to see it. I believe our county leadership would like to see it, but I've not been privy to any discussions. There's lots of rumors. I've been hearing for 2 weeks that the governor was considering it, but I don't have any hard evidence to that. I'm not privy to those conversations that are occurring. I do know that there are other counties that are considering seeking exemptions to allow for mask orders. And I do suspect that if those exemption requests were put in place in front of the governor, he would approve them. But we're all waiting. We're kind of don't know quite what to expect.
Yeah. Lots of school districts across the state releasing their plans about reopening for the upcoming school year. We heard from Park City School District. They're not ready to release theirs yet. We have heard from South Summit. Sounds like they've got a good plan in place. How is the county helping the three school districts prepare these?
Well, first of all, I want to be really clear. The county and the health department doesn't have jurisdiction over these plans. And also to clear up a prominent rumor out there, the health department and I did not close the schools. That was an issuance of an order by the governor. And so where we're involved is we had a meeting. I had a meeting with the superintendents last week. They've been very transparent with their plans. And obviously there are guidelines that the State Office of Education has issued and the governor has supported. But there's variability within those plans. And, you know, what's most impressed me is that all of the districts have done surveys. They've surveyed their parents, they've surveyed their teachers and their staff and faculty, trying to figure out what they want, what they need for their education. And you know, that's what this is really all about. The parents obviously are most important resource and most cherished asset in our communities are our children. And so I'm very impressed by the way that the school boards and the superintendents and parents and teachers are all working together to try to figure this out. On the flip side of that, from the public health side, we're trying to figure out as public health officials how we track cases, because there will almost certainly be cases in schools. And we don't want to be in a situation where we're having to isolate large number of students. And so we're trying to figure out how we identify the cases early, trace their contacts, and isolate appropriately, similar to some other conditions like pertussis or some other condition in schools. So we're not taking these sweeping measures and we're not forced in. You know, for example, Wasatch had a single case and had to isolate 27. 2,700 people last school year, 2,700 students. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be in that situation, so we're trying to figure out that balance.
Okay. I'm out of time, but I know there's a lot more to talk about. But, Rich, I always appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Thanks.
And likewise, Leslie. Thank you.
Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bullo. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City State.